From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our special guest on this edition of the program is Robert F. Wirth. He's the author of the recently published book, A Rage for Order, The Middle East in Turmoil from Tahrir Square to ISIS. Robert Wirth spent 14 years as a correspondent for The New York Times and was the paper's Beirut bureau chief from 2007 to 2011. He is currently a contributing writer at The New York Times Magazine. His highly acclaimed new book, A Rage for Order, tracks the tormented legacy of what was once called the Arab Spring, from Tunisia, where the uprisings began, to Egypt, Libya, Syria, and Yemen. Robert chronicles the initial euphoria and then deep disappointment and even heartbreak as the rebellions failed to live up to their lofty aspirations. In Syria, peaceful protests, inspired by events in Tunisia, were initially met with sniper fire and later barrel bombs by President Bashar al-Assad, whose regime, later reinforced by Iranian-backed militias and Russia's Vladimir Putin, is partially responsible for having spawned the growth of ISIS and having triggered the massive wave of refugees flooding into Europe. Of the five countries that attempted to throw off the yoke of their dictators, from Egypt's Hosni Mubarak to Libya's Muammar Gaddafi, only Tunisia appears to have long-term promise. Robert Wirth says the book originated with his, quote, zigzag efforts to follow the course of the uprisings and their aftermath between 2011 and 2013. Parts of it are adapted from his articles in the New York Times when he was based in Baghdad and Beirut. Robert Wirth concludes that what happened in 2011 was not so much a beginning as an end, the final disintegration of something that had been rotting for decades, he says in the book's introduction. The Arab Republican states finally collapse of their own weight. The problem is what has come after is much murkier, much darker than anyone could have predicted. With us to discuss A Rage for Order, from Tahrir Square to ISIS, is the author himself, Robert F. Wirth. Robert, welcome to the program.
Thanks. It's nice to be here.
And some of you may remember Robert from his participation as a valued panelist on our Encounter show as well. Well, Robert, we're delighted to have you here as our sole guest, the author of your new book, A Rage for Order. Congratulations.
Thank you.
You have gotten stellar reviews and certainly well-deserved. Now, you say in the introduction that the Arab Spring exemplifies the so-called final disintegration of something that had been rotting for decades, and that it's more of an end than a beginning. Explain what you mean by that.
Well, I think these states had, in the past couple of decades, become almost less about governing than about obtaining money and redistributing it among a network of cronies. That ultimately was the purpose of this group, and governing became a sideline. In some cases, they deliberately hollowed out the functions of government. Yemen is perhaps one of the most egregious cases of that, so that these states eventually were no longer even able to do the job that they had previously been so good at, which is, you know, surveilling and repressing and crushing any form of dissent. They didn't even do that well. So I think, in a sense, some kind of uprising, whether it took place in 2011 or later, was inevitable. I think these states just no longer could handle the most minimal job.
So how then do you explain the apparent failure of the Arab Spring in general, notwithstanding the potential success of Tunisia, in producing a real transition toward democracy? What are the factors, the shortcomings, do you think, prevented the protesters from ultimately triumphing?
I think the protesters, the ones that got the most coverage and media play in the United States, were the small group of admirable, well-educated, mostly middle-class young people who had aspirations for a much healthier, more engaged civic society than the one they grew up in. In part, that was because they were much more aware of the outside world than their parents' generation had been. And their aspirations were admirable and noble, and they really captured the hearts of people all over the world. But I think many of them didn't quite recognize just how far their societies were from being able to sustain those aspirations. And that was partly because, as I say, these autocracies had done such a good job of eliminating any opposition. There was no political center in these places. There was either the regime on the one hand or its Islamist opposition on the other. And to some extent, that Islamist opposition was a creation of the regime. It was held up as a scarecrow in order to obtain Western support to help oppress the Islamists. And you really needed something more than that. You needed people who could speak out for some middle ground, some reforms of the administrative system. And that administration, in large measure, was a house of cards. It was bloated. It was corrupt. It wasn't doing its job. And it had all kinds of horrible patterns of repression and torture, which were part of what started the Arab Spring in the first place. So without that kind of middle ground, very quickly the polarization in Egypt and other countries became apparent, and you got a kind of an incipient civil war taking place. And that's what you have today.
Indeed. Of course, Egypt does come to mind, and you just mentioned that. No political center, a very strong Islamist opposition, which seems to have overpowered the protest movement. Talk about the Egyptian uprising and why it ended up not achieving its major goals.
I think for people who were there during the 18 days of Tahrir Square, it was an incredibly inspiring moment because many of us, certainly correspondents who covered the region, were pretty cynical about the possibility of real political change. And all of a sudden, you had this moment in which everybody suddenly seemed to be standing not for partisan political interests, but for a unified national message. Everybody in Tahrir Square seemed to agree. Every now and then, you would hear some person, for instance, I heard an Islamist once starting an Islamist chant, "We want an Islamic state." And everybody told him, "Shut up, that's not the message." And he stopped. Obviously, in retrospect, one can imagine that that was partly a matter of calculation, that the Islamists wanted to hide amongst the general populace in order to present what looked like a more Western-friendly message, get rid of Mubarak, and then take over in an Islamist fashion. I think that's not entirely fair because many of those people, especially the younger ones in the Muslim Brotherhood, which is, of course, the dominant Islamist network, and not just in Egypt, but in the Arab world, I think they had seen the power of this message, the way that it resonated with so many ordinary Egyptians who were not political. And they began to think anew that this was maybe something that they should rethink their politics, that this was a form of civic belonging that everybody could aspire to. I think everybody changed a little bit during those 18 days. The trouble was that once the immediate goal appeared to have been achieved, that Mubarak had to step down, people weren't sure where to go with it. And so they just fell naturally back towards the inclinations they'd had previously, whatever those might have been. The more liberal, secular-oriented Egyptians immediately became frightened and anxious and defensive about an Islamist takeover. And the Islamists naturally began to move towards, well, what is the model for a better government? They only could think of one. Of course, it was a very divisive one and not a very well-prepared one. And it ended up winning in the elections at the polls, but it ended up being a very rigid and unhelpful way to govern and eventually collapsed in a coup.
Do you see a certain irony now that we have Sisi, the current leader, coming from the military? Some say he is almost worse in terms of his repression, worse than Mubarak in a way. How do you see the trajectory of the Egyptian uprising now with Sisi?
Well, I think you have to look at 2013, which is really the turning point after 2011. What happened then, of course, was that Mohamed Morsi, who had been elected freely and fairly in 2012, he was the Muslim Brotherhood candidate, who was elected, by the way, in 2012 because it came down in the runoff to two figures. One was Ahmed Shafiq, who quite clearly represented the old regime, had been close to Mubarak, and then Mohamed Morsi, who was a really unknown figure, but who was put up by the Muslim Brotherhood. And just enough people were willing to go with Morsi because they didn't want to go back at that point to the old regime. So they voted for Morsi, kind of crossing their fingers and thinking, well, maybe he'll govern more like an Egyptian than like a member of the Brotherhood. He didn't really. He was a through and through organization man. He was disastrously incompetent. At the same time, you have to acknowledge that he never got a fair chance to try to govern. I mean, he resisted at every step by the remnants of the old regime. That's the word you often hear in Egypt, remnants. They are because falul. So both things are true, and I think that's important to recognize, that he never really got a chance to govern in his own way, and yet he also made all kinds of catastrophic mistakes. Partly mistakes of form, of appearances, that he wasn't able to speak to people in a way that engendered the kind of trust that he needed to engender. And so eventually, I think enough people felt this new Islamist president is so frightening, it's so bad, and this vision of a kind of Iran-style takeover that so many people had in their minds was so frightening that it would be better to go back to what they knew. And I think many of them supported Sisi because they felt, let's just go back to stability no matter how it looks. And in that context, that summer of 2013, when the military ejected Mohamed Morsi, and eventually, of course, Sisi took over as president in a pretty scripted election, I think people felt that he was a savior. But many of them since then, in the 3 years since then, have begun to recognize that he's not a savior. He represents the rigid, corrupt old system, and in some ways, as you mentioned, worse than the old system, because he's cracking down not just on the Muslim Brotherhood, but on anyone who criticizes the regime at all. Current Egyptian government has become more defensive and more brittle than the Mubarak regime was, and it behaves that way. And what's also very important to recognize is that it was the security apparatus of the old regime in Egypt, as in all these other Arab governments, that really precipitated all these protests in 2011. And that appears to be just as bad as ever in Egypt now, if not worse, because all kinds of people are getting picked up and arrested, being tortured, and they've gone farther in some cases, as we all saw with the torture and murder of the Italian student, Giulio Regeni, several months back. Many of the people who were at the forefront of the 2011 protests are now in jail. And that it's not just a question of civil liberties and arrests. Economically, there was some hope that Sisi, even if he was repressive in some obvious ways, would at least get things going economically. After all, that's a huge factor in all these countries. People were upset in 2011, not just because of civic liberties, but because they wanted bread. And that was one of the rallying cries of those revolutions. But Sisi really has not done the reforms people hoped he would do. He's dredged up all kinds of big, unpromising, statist economic ideas from the 1970s and 80s. And he does not appear poised to bring Egypt through to a new era.
And he also has re-banned the Muslim Brotherhood, correct?
Yes, and thrown its entire leadership in jail. Of course, many of them got out of the country, and you can find some of them particularly in Doha, in Qatar, on the Gulf, and in Turkey, where many of them are living in exile and continuing to broadcast on the internet and so forth. And they're struggling to redefine themselves, but that's difficult because their very top leaders remain in jail incommunicado.
We'll have more in just a moment, but first, you're listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. Our guest is Robert Wirth, former correspondent for The New York Times, currently contributor to The New York Times Magazine, and author of the new book, A Rage for Order, The Middle East in Turmoil from Tahrir Square to ISIS. I'm Carol Castiel. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. And here's a shout out to a loyal fan from Maiduguri, Nigeria, Farouk Rabiu Salawa. If you want to hear your name on the show, please send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to you, our author, Robert Wirth, the author of A Rage for Order. Now, speaking of which, in retrospect, given the Arab Spring's slide into autocracy like in Egypt, civil war now in Syria and Yemen, have the autocrats, in a sense, won, Robert?
Well, for the moment, there is a kind of a strange symbiotic relationship in the Middle East between autocrats, many of them the same ones, of course, as before 2011, and jihadi groups. And I think too often people look at these autocrats and say, well, look, we were wrong to go with democracy and it just led to chaos. These guys may be corrupt and thuggish, but at least they preserve some kind of order. That's the solution. I think what's wrong about that is because there is a clear relationship between this kind of rule and the jihadism, and its worst form, of course, ISIS. I think they helped to engender that, and not just by the torture, the repression, and so forth, but also because government had become so unaccountable. Again, it was less government than a kind of a network for distributing state money and oil and so forth to a group of cronies who were connected. And the vast bulk of the population was left out of that. It led to just the kind of terrible desperation that is a great seeding ground for radicalism of all kinds. So I think we need to recognize that until we get to a better form of government in the Middle East, and as I say, I think probably only Tunisia at this point represents a possibility there. We're going to continue to see more radical groups being formed, even if the coalition defeats ISIS in Iraq and Syria, which doesn't appear to be happening very quickly. The question will remain, who will govern those areas, which after all are mostly desert and are full of people who feel existentially threatened by the remaining autocrats in the region? Unless we can find an alternative for those people, they will probably turn to another group like ISIS.
And of course, Syria certainly comes to mind. Some people are saying that Bashar al-Assad, whose very presence, many would argue, helped to foster the growth of the so-called Islamic State, basically exemplifying what you just said, this symbiotic relationship between autocrats and jihadis, that somehow he is better than the alternative, than ISIS. In my view, this belies this confusion between somebody like him, Assad, and ISIS, because if you really examine their techniques, they're similar. The torture Bashar al-Assad has used and continues to use on his own people, he just does it behind the scenes, whereas ISIS beheads people right in front of the video camera. And I've heard some analysts say that both hark back to Ba'athist, you know, ideology and techniques, this torture, this similarity. And yet we're seeing today some people saying somehow he's still better than the alternative.
No, I think you're right. And I think it's not just Syria, it's Iraq as well. After all, many of the leading figures within ISIS were Iraqi Ba'athist commanders. And the levels of violence that took place in Iraq for those many years, which we weren't necessarily exposed to, people in the West are aware of some of the most egregious incidents that came out later, like the gassing of Kurds in Halabja in 1988. But there was a routine level of torture and violence in Iraq in particular, worse than Syria, really. And I think it's one of those things that reproduces itself in the same way that people who were abused as children and often, not always, become abusers as adults. And I think we should also recognize that the creation of ISIS is a complex phenomenon. It's not just Bashar al-Assad. It's not just the Iraqi state. It's not just the spread of jihadism throughout the region. I think we have to recognize also that the American invasion of Iraq in 2003, and more particularly the decisions that followed it to cashier the entire Iraqi military, to do de-Ba'athification, which left a whole lot of people out of work, out of money, but with an enormous, enormous anger against the United States, that really prepared the ground as well. So it's a complex stew. But certainly the role of these dictators is important now in maintaining the system. It's important for Bashar al-Assad to be able to say, look, it's me or this. And if there's an emergence of some middle ground of a third way, life gets more difficult for him.
Very true. And staying on the theme of Syria, you argue in the book that many Syrians were united in opposing Bashar al-Assad, but divided in what they wanted to come next. How decisive was that in Syria?
Well, I think it was less a matter of conflicting political visions, because I don't think people even got that far in Syria. I think the protesters really admirably disciplined in their message of nonviolence, and many of them tried very hard early on to focus particularly on the question of sectarianism. They knew this was their Achilles heel, and they knew that this was the regime's strongest card to play against them. So you heard a lot of slogans, you know, no Sunnis and Alawis united, no to sectarianism, and so forth. But the wounds were too recent and raw for them to succeed with that. And the regime, like many other Arab regimes, they were too expert. I mean, they had honed their skills for decades at divide and conquer. And that is what they did. Assad, as you know, released many jihadis from prisons. His government also spread all kinds of rumors. They would spread a rumor in Sunni communities about Alawi men coming in jeeps with guns to kill people, and they do the opposite, you know, in the other communities. My chapter on Syria in the book actually focuses on this as seen from the perspective of ordinary people, of a particular family, two young women who were friends, and the way that they heard a completely different, almost two different worlds, you know, within the same town. They had been best friends, but they began to hear different rumors, read different news reports, and even hear different stories about their country's history.
Because they were of different
exactly
communities. One was an Alawi and the other a Sunni.
Exactly. So that divide was not just at the level of broad politics. It was about ordinary people and what they heard, what they understood. And it created this wall between them.
And it's very sad in the case of Syria, because it really truly is a multicultural, multi-ethnic, multi-religious country. The Alawis, the Sunni, Christians, Jews, they see themselves as one. But because Bashar al-Assad exploited these differences, it has really disintegrated.
It's really true. And it's worth saying that for people who have lived in these places and spent time there, I mean, that's exactly one of the things that you value most is the richness and diversity of these countries and their incredible history. And, you know, it's reflected in all kinds of ways, down to the sort of recipes and things, the food that you'd find in different areas and the different markets and the different architecture. It's wonderful. And sadly, that is now being used to set people against each other.
Now, you say in the book that the United States was not a major player in the Arab Spring, and it would not have made much of a difference what the United States did or didn't do. But some analysts would disagree, saying that perhaps a different posture vis-a-vis Egypt, and especially Syria, might have altered the trajectory of the uprisings if the United States had backed words with deeds. Now, I'm particularly referring to Syria, perhaps helping early on the defectors from the Syrian Armed Forces, which then became the Free Syria Army, providing greater political support to the local coordinating committees, the diaspora, perhaps even arms to defeat the onslaught by Assad, who basically cracked down on these peaceful protests, so they had no choice but to defend themselves. When that didn't happen, of course, he called in Hezbollah, other Iranian-backed militias, and then we saw the Russians get involved last September. Basically, he's really riding high now. We recall also that President Obama issued the so-called famous red line, whereby if he used chemical weapons, which was alleged, that we would take action, but we did not. So once again, do you still believe that the United States wouldn't have made much of a difference?
I think that different American policies probably could have saved more lives, perhaps many more lives. What I meant when I said that the U.S. couldn't have made a huge difference is that I doubt that the different American policies could have changed the fundamental situation in those countries, the broad array of forces there. I also, incidentally, since you mentioned it, think that it was a mistake by Obama to lay down that red line and then to pull away from it. I think that engendered all kinds of suspicion and anger and disappointment among his allies that affected the way things played out in Syria. I think it was a real mistake. But I also think that almost anything the United States might have done to fundamentally alter the outcome in terms of toppling Bashar and so forth could have been countered effectively by Iran and Russia. After all, Iran has a much deeper stake in what happens in Syria than the United States does. For us, it's a matter of mostly humanitarian concern, and I don't want to underplay that, but Iran sees Syria as a really existential connection. They feel that if Damascus falls, then Tehran is next. And so there's almost no limit to what they would be willing to invest.
Interesting.
To keep the country on their side.
And that's precisely the reason why some members of Congress and other analysts were saying that is why the United States, with its allies, France in particular, could have made a difference. And that would have changed the strategic landscape for the United States had we been able to, you know, weaken Damascus, who, of course, is backed to the hilt by Iran. But again, these are historical ifs.
Exactly. And I also think we need to recognize that the Iranians are very, very good at undermining things. I mean, they've proved that, and they've had a lot of practice at it in Iraq over the past 12 years. They may not be very good at building things, but they're certainly good at undermining, as they've done in southern Iraq in particular. And what you can see there is, even when it affects them, this kind of chaos, my point is simply that they have had all the opportunity in the world in southern Iraq to infiltrate and to influence to the point where many people feel that southern Iraq is really almost part of Iran now. And yet, you still see lots and lots of infighting between those Shiite factions because Iran is very good at sowing distrust and chaos. It's not really good at unifying. And I think the same would have been true in Syria. If the United States, perhaps with its allies, had made a much more ambitious effort to create an alternative to Assad, I think Iran would have played a brilliantly insidious hand at destroying that. And that would have forced the United States and its allies to bid up, to do more. I think Obama decided from early on that he wasn't willing to do that because, let's face it, it would have been overwhelmingly the Americans who would have had to done that.
In the very few minutes we have left, Robert, I want you to touch on Libya and Tunisia. Libya is now a topic in the U.S. presidential campaign. And, of course, it was unique from the very beginning with a dictator that deliberately failed for decades to establish solid state institutions. And as I said, we're hearing from all sides what a so-called disaster Libya has become. But I recall in March 2011, there was a decision to protect Libyans. The responsibility to protect from the United Nations was invoked. We had the Arab League, the UN Security Council, and the EU. They backed this limited action to protect civilians. But now it's being seen as a disaster. Many critics say, well, it was a lack of follow-through. Air power alone would not have been sufficient. How do you see Libya today?
Well, first of all, I would say what's happened in Libya is a tragedy. You know, for someone who's spent time there and has friends there and has followed it and written about it, it's just been awful to see this collapse and this fragmentation. You know, I wrote a lot about a particular massacre that took place in August of 2011, just as Gaddafi's forces were fleeing from Tripoli, the capital. And I spent a lot of time with the survivors of that massacre, which took place in a makeshift prison, and stayed in touch with them and went back to Libya. Those survivors ended up forming a brigade, captured many of their jailers. And there was a lot of hope that this eventually would lead to some kind of reconciliation, some understanding, a truth and justice commission, something like that. And more information would be gathered about this massacre in particular, but about also about everything else that took place in that year. Well, that's all been dropped and almost forgotten now because there's been so much more bloodshed since then. It's tragic to have that happen. But I think it's also important to recognize that what happened in Libya is a Libyan tragedy. It's not an American tragedy. I think the United States was justified in trying to prevent a massacre in March of 2011. I think it's wrong to believe that we could have fundamentally altered the outcome there, just as it is in Syria. I knew Christopher Stevens somewhat, the American ambassador who was killed in September 2012. He knew, I think, as much about Libya, at least Libya's status at that time, as any American, maybe as much as any foreigner living in the country. And he made decisions about where to go based on the knowledge he had. Now, he died because he took some risks. I think diplomacy always entails some risks. His death was a tragedy. But again, I think it's wrong for us to second guess him, we who don't know as much as he did. What happened there is not because we invested too much or too little or because we didn't do this or because we didn't do that. I think what happened has to do with Libya's history, has to do with Gaddafi, has to do with the various factions there. I think the United States should stay engaged, but also recognize what the limits of our abilities are.
Indeed, limits, but perhaps collecting weaponry after the U.S. and EU and Arab League intervention, could more have been done to collect the weapons so that they wouldn't fall into the hands of the militias? Might that have made a difference?
It might have made a difference, but remember, there were so many militias at that time, and they were determined to hold on to them. I know a Libyan politician who's very well connected with the American government, and he actually said, I remember back in December of 2011, after Gaddafi's death, after the civil war had ended, he said, now's the moment. We have to disarm these militias now. And he told his American interlocutors, what everybody told him was, it's going to be really bloody and violent if we do that, right? You can't just say, please give this to me. They're going to fight you. And everybody had just gone through a really bloody eight-month civil war. So there were some good reasons given, but he couldn't get anybody to buy into that. Now, maybe he's right. Maybe that was the last chance to prevent this. But he failed.
All right. Let's conclude with the country that sparked the Arab Spring, Tunisia. It's probably, as you said, and many others have said, perhaps the last best hope. What do you think makes Tunisia a more promising model?
Well, first of all, Tunisia has a number of things going for it that some of these other countries don't. It's small. It doesn't have oil. It doesn't have a large army. The army is also pretty non-political. It had an autocrat, if you want to call him a dictator, but he was such a good autocrat that I would not call him a dictator, Habib Bourguiba, who for decades played a pretty constructive role. He also made mistakes. He was definitely an autocrat, but compared to the other ones in the region, Saddam Hussein and so forth, he was pretty benign. So they had a good base to build on. They also have an Islamist movement that is much more sophisticated and flexible than other Islamist movements. And in fact, recently, that movement, Ennahda, declared publicly that it is not an Islamist movement, that it is really more a party of Muslim Democrats. And I think you could call this an opportunistic display of PR. I don't really think that's true. I think for the past 3 years, that movement, Ennahda, which is led by Rashid Ghannouchi, has been behaving like a non-Islamist movement. They've showed an amazing ability to prioritize Tunisia and its people above themselves as a movement. And in fact, Ghannouchi has repeatedly said, look, this is not about us. We are not as important as a movement as the preservation of a democratic civic space in this country. And we have to sacrifice our selfish ambitions as a party for those of the country. And so his party voluntarily stepped down from power despite having been freely elected. They collaborated with the opposition. They made many concessions in the rewriting of the constitution, and they have continued to work with the opposition ever since then. Now, Tunisia is obviously very fragile. There are all kinds of threats, but I think those ingredients make it a much better bet.
The book is A Rage for Order, The Middle East in Turmoil, From Tahrir Square to ISIS. The author, Robert F. Wirth, former correspondent and Beirut bureau chief for The New York Times. Robert, congratulations again on this terrific book.
Thank you so much.
And thanks for coming and sharing your insights.
It's a pleasure.
Press Conference USA on The Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guest. Our engineer was Howard Smith. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on The Voice of America.